Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 5th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. We're delighted to be joined today by Alex Thompson. Alex, of course, bringing Eastern approaches and reporting from the depths of the Netherlands. Well, quite hot at the moment, and apparently it's going to be very hot here in UK. Do you think we should put a special warning out for our viewers in case they don't know how to deal with the hot weather?
Depends whether it gets to national emergency level or not.
It could be. It could be so hot it's a national emergency. So we advise people to take precautions, certainly consult your local council, probably email your MP for advice on that hot weather. Well, let's move into politics, and clearly Theresa May is in trouble because she's looking to recruit some new media people, also known as the propaganda experts. And she had two people in mind. She had James Landale and Robbie Gibb here, both senior members of the BBC. So this would all appear to be a good plan. Bring the BBC right in alongside the Prime Minister's office so that you can simply control the news and the propaganda in one go.
Excellent.
But unfortunately, in the last few moments, it's all gone wrong because one of them has pulled out. And I don't know whether he wrote a letter, but Mr. Landale certainly tweeted out that he'd been asked about the job at Number 10. It was nice to have that offer, but he's decided to stay with the BBC.
Theresa's a bit toxic, even for the BBC.
Theresa's a bit toxic, and presumably his great big fat paycheck from the BBC was a big attraction. Here's the other man, just in case you're worried that the whole thing has collapsed. This is Robbie Gibbs. He's a Conservative. Well, he's worked. His brother was Conservative Minister Nick Gibb, and he worked for ex-Tory grandee Michael Portillo. So clearly she's bringing the boys into the fold.
Any thoughts, Alex?
Well, I've never heard of Robbie Gibb. I wonder if he's the long-lost brother of the Bee Gees. But seriously, there's a lot of musical chairs going on at the moment. If you follow order.com, the Guido Fawkes site, they're the best now at tracking who's who in Westminster, and they keep a spreadsheet of the special advisers, the SPADs. And after each election and reshuffle, you'd be amazed how many new people come in. And if you look up their names, they're often mid-20s and have got, you know, no experience of the real world before, during or since university. They kind of grew up in a gilded cage. This lot you're covering now seem a few years older than that, but still, where's the real world experience?
Indeed. Okay, let's move on then, because the government has announced a new roads policy for the country. This is fantastic news. It's the Transport Investment Strategy. It's been £61 billion over 5 years up until 2021. So this is great. I have captioned this graphic road charging with a question mark. The question mark is purely optional because I believe that that's exactly what we're looking at here, and we'll explain why in a second. So the investment that they've announced today with the Transport Investment Strategy is setting out, they say, how their investment will create a more reliable, less congested and better connected transport network that works for the users that rely on it.
Sorry, I'm chuckling, Mike, as usual, because I've done a lot of driving over the last few months, as you have. And of course, what do we see as intelligent motorways come into force? The traffic gets slower.
Right. They're going to build a stronger, more balanced economy by enhancing productivity and responding to local growth priorities. They're going to enhance global competitiveness by making Britain a more attractive place to trade and invest. And they're going to support the creation of new housing. So this is absolutely fantastic. This is Chris Grayling has announced this. And as part of the strategy, Chris Grayling has announced his intention to launch a consultation on the creation of a major road network. And that's mainly going to be bypasses on A roads, Brian. So the first bit of news, of course, is at the M5, M6 junction. This is Spaghetti Junction on screen there. The main M5, M6 junction is effectively going to close. They say they're going to keep it open, but they're going to restrict it to a contraflow with a 30-mile-per-hour speed limit on it. So that is one of the major hubs, one of the major sort of crossing points in the country. Huge amounts of freight traffic going through that every day. That is going to be a nightmare for the next 18 months.
Well, it's an ongoing nightmare, isn't it? Because everybody's watched the purple clad cabling that's been appearing alongside the motorways, and indeed is being buried alongside the motorways, and that is all part of the cabling for the road charging. And we know the sensors are already in much of the motorways in order to pick your car up when this system comes in.
Absolutely. Now, why are we interested in this? Well, back in 2010, of course, David Cameron had unveiled his plan to sell off the roads. This wasn't quite the plan which the Anna Rothschild had attempted to encourage the government to push through. They wanted the government simply to sell the roads network to them, and they reckoned that the roads would be valued at around £100 billion, I think it was at the time. Cameron had decided that, well, perhaps we'll do something slightly different, where we'll allow sort of investment funds to come in, a sort of semi-privatization of trunk roads and motorways. So sovereign wealth funds from China and other countries, leasing roads in England and then charging by the mile. And then Miles Elliott last week in 21st Century Wire published this article, Technocracy Inc., How Charging for Roads, Now Charging for Roads by the Mile. And this is the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, publishing a transport strategy which outlines exactly that. So anybody wanting to travel through the centre of London, not only the congestion charge, but per mile charges, because he intends to become the greenest mayor. And of course, he is becoming the greenest mayor because the city agenda is to push through, no matter what national governments might do, to push through with the Paris Climate Agreement and so on. So cities are going to drive this agenda, but it's looking increasingly to me, Brian, like the government is investing in infrastructure with a view to future road charging, at the very least, if not full privatisation.
Don't think there's any question of that, Mike. And the thing is that all of these huge roadworks, much of it putting in central concrete barriers and the huge gantries going across the road, not only with the speed cameras, but also with the number plate recognition cameras and the cameras recording the people inside vehicles. All of that has gone into place, representing billions of pounds of expenditure, with not a single statement from Westminster as to what the ultimate objective was. So people have just driven through these traffic jams. They've seen the new signs go up. They've seen these gantries go in. These are the gantries that are going to take the charging mechanism, as it were. But no debate in Westminster on this at all. Simply an announcement drifted into the public psyche.
Adrian in the chat box saying Britain's road infrastructure has got to be worth trillions, surely. Well, I don't know about that. But of course, the £100 billion estimate was being pushed forward by NM Rothschild, who had expressed an interest in getting involved in that. So I would say that their assessment should be taken in that context, that they were interested in getting involved. Of course, the question that continues to be asked, or should be asked, is why people are not using railways rather than trains and rather than roads. And of course, the answer to that is because railways are so horrendously expensive in this country. And so why is it, for example, that we can take a flight from Bristol to Milan or Rome for significantly less than it costs to get from Bristol to London on the train? I mean, it is a ridiculous situation. There is no competition in the transport systems in Britain.
No, but we could take ourselves back to Mr. Beeching in 1963, I think it was, and have a look at the close down of Britain's excellent rail network. We'll save that for another time.
So let's move on to higher education. This is the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and they've published a report today on higher education funding in England, past, present and options for the future. And they're talking, of course, about student debt. And they're saying higher education in England has been subject to near constant reform for the past two decades. The most notable of these was the 2012 trebling of tuition fees to £9,000. Higher education is an area where England is a genuine world leader, having long boasted several of the world's finest universities, yet that position is increasingly under threat from increased global competition. So they've published this article, this report. They're saying that there's been a huge shift in the way government funds higher education, from upfront grants to student loans. And they're making the point that students, on average, are graduating with a debt of £50,000, Brian, 50 grand, and even more if you're from a poorer background. And they're saying that that student loans differ from private loans because repayments are proportionate to income. Now, the Times had a look at this report this morning and published this article. Three quarters of graduates will never pay off student debt. And they put this little graph with it, or this little infographic. And they're making the point that under the terms of the student loans, you know, it's only people that are coming out of university and going straight into a job paying £45,000 or higher that would end up paying back the student loan that they've taken out.
Now, some people, huge amounts, with huge amounts of interest.
Huge amounts of interest, yes. So the £50,000 initial debt, if you were coming out of university, going straight onto a salary of £45,000, you would end up paying back £149,000 in total. So this is huge for whichever private company is running this. It's, of course, the student loans company. And it would take 29 years to pay that off.
So this is putting young people into debt. A student loan company based in Scotland, of course, and the majority of the funders behind it are foreign banks. So our young people put into debt at the hands of foreign bankers. A deliberate policy, in my opinion, Mike.
Absolutely. But of course, this seems to incentivize students aiming for lower quality jobs at the end of the day because they've got this debt hanging around their necks. And, you know, how do they come out of university, therefore, and immediately start thinking about a job and a mortgage, which is...
Well, it totally gets rid of the mortgage, Mike. I think this is what it was designed to do. It was to help force these young people into taking on rented accommodation. And that's a subject we're going to be talking about more as we have a look at housing associations, where the rumour at the moment is that we're going to see more government control of those housing associations. So young people being stripped of their wealth and forced into controlled accommodation.
So, Alex, you've still got pretty strong connections to the academic community. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, things have moved with lightning rapidity in the 20 years since I matriculated. I was one of the last generation to have a fully funded, by my county's local education authority, fully funded degree. They paid the whole grant, not the accommodation, but they paid the tuition fees. And that was just about doable. And then when I got a job with GCHQ in 2001, it was a darn sight less than 40 grand, but I was still whacked for the repayments, as you would expect, and I managed to repay them. But I think that we're on that steep point of the curve, that notch where it goes upwards, where suddenly, before you know it, a few years after your own experience, things have changed utterly. And it seems that, you know, the equivalent of what I was earning then would perhaps be about 30,000 now if you were a new starter. So by notching that up to 40 grand, it's not just reflecting inflation or real terms wage deflation. It's actually, as you say, a deliberate policy to make sure that these students think, well, hang it, why should I ever get a proper professional job? So I do see skullduggery in there. If you look at certain octopus-like organisations and investors who seem to have, you know, never make a losing bet on government, they seem to have worked out that the British government and some of the ones over here, like the Dutch government, are on the verge of making it obligatory to study till you're 21. They seem to be pushing in that direction behind the scenes because they know that that would be brilliant for substandard student accommodation and for student loans if you're in those two holdings. These asset classes are being marketed vigorously to Arab and Chinese investors, as far as I can see. And if you want to know what the gravy train is like in academia, you could do a lot worse than read Kenneth Roy's recent series of articles on the Scottish Review, just about the expense claims by the so-called senior management team of professors at Glasgow University. It's a shocker.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so let's move on to extremism then. This report from the Henry Jackson Society has come out today. This is such a coincidence because yesterday Theresa May was suffering a little bit of a scandal, as if she would, for suppressing the report which David Cameron had ordered back in 2016, I think it was January 2016, which was looking into foreign funding of extremism in the United Kingdom, and particularly Saudi Arabian funding of extremism in the UK. And Theresa May, of course, Home Secretary at the time, has been accused ever since of sitting on that report, hiding it. So yesterday, The Guardian and others reporting Caroline Lucas's from the Green Party, her intervention on this, and saying, you know, really putting pressure on Theresa May to release the report. And today, this Henry Jackson Society report is out. Foreign Funding Islamic Extremism in the UK. They're saying it's highlighting the need for a public inquiry into the foreign-based funding of Islamic extremism. They say that they're reporting on the growing body of evidence on the considerable impact that foreign funding has on Islamic extremism in Britain. And they are absolutely identifying Saudi Arabia as being the foremost funder. And of course, we've said this ourselves, Brian, that Saudi Arabia is pushing money into British mosques, and they're also pushing Wahhabist imams into the mosques as well. Henry Jackson Society saying in the UK, this funding has primarily taken the form of endowments to mosques and Islamic education institutions, which have apparently in turn played host to Islamist extremist preachers. And the distribution of Islamist extremist literature. So that's going on. And in parallel with that then, RUSI has pushed this out today. This article is entitled Suspicious Activities on Social Media, What Can Be Learned from Counter-Terrorist Financing Efforts. This is by Oliver Kraft, who's a research fellow at the Centre for Financial Crime and Security Studies. And he's saying expecting private companies to report terrorist-related activities is not unprecedented. It's consistent with recommendations of the Financial Action Task Force, the global standard setter in the area of anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing. And financial institutions are required to file a suspicious transaction report if they suspect any funds to be related to terrorist financing. Accordingly, transaction reports may provide a useful point of reference when considering recent proposals to introduce reporting requirements for certain types of social media content. Technological progress has therefore created the room and possibly the need for stronger private sector involvement in monitoring of communications. And Brian, what I'm going to ask Alex this as well, but what this seems to suggest to me is the point that you've been making, I think, for the last couple of years, that in fact, when we're facing the surveillance culture that we are, that the way to defeat that is to throw more content at it and more content at it. And this seems to be a reaction to that, because what they seem to be admitting here, or RUSI is hinting at, is that the security services perhaps can't cope, and therefore they've got to co-opt commercial organisations to sort of do their jobs for them at a certain level.
Well, I think that would make sense. If you don't like the spying, in my opinion, the best way to deal with it is to feed it the information it wants. What information you want to feed it is up to you. But the other thing I think we should ask is, who is RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute? What is this organisation really? Because it puts itself forward as an independent think tank. It claims the Royal Charter, as it were. But who are these people, and what business have they got advising us in Britain? If you look at most of them, they're internationalists. They're working all sorts of internationalist, globalist agendas. I don't trust these people from the outset. I think they're here trying to help drive the policy.
Hmm. Alex?
I would echo Brian's point there. The Royal United Services Institute, as the name suggests, claims to be something representing the interests of servicemen. And they don't have, when they're doing their excellent jobs correctly, they don't have anything to do with counterterrorism apart from to mop it up when it goes wrong. Obviously, there is military intelligence, but that is always something that's foreign focused in essence. Counterterrorism in the pure sense of looking at your own domestic population and the terrorism suspects within them has to be a civilian intelligence agency operation with police feeds into it. And it's got really very little to do with the military. So I've been to RUSI talks when I was still a civil servant, and I was never impressed by the attitude. It was very finger wagging and not very knowledgeable. And yes, as Mike says, the content-driven approach is taking over, or rather the contractor content-driven approach, because, yes, there is now saturation. There are too many people who are allegedly suspects for the agencies to look at. Okay, they might have doubled their staff several times in the last few years, but still, the number of people they're looking at is more than doubling every few years. It's much more asymptotic growth. So in the end, you have to go the NSA route of using pretty much 10 times as many contractors as in-house staff, and each of them is managing, as it were, the equivalent of 10 men in computer power. That's the only way to do it, and ultimately you end up surveilling the whole population.
Okay, now, Alex, I want to just draw this to your attention, because over the last number of months, we've been pointing out the increasing moves towards a Europeanized system of so-called justice in this country. So this is courts and tribunal service. Just just going to be very quick on this. The launch of the business and property courts, and they're saying that this happened yesterday. They're saying the new business and property courts of England and Wales are to be launched yesterday evening at a launch at the Rolls Building in London. This is the first in a series of launches across the country. The new arrangements will enhance the connection between the specialist business and property work undertaken by in the regions and in London. In London, these specialist jurisdictions operate together in the Rolls Building. The new arrangements will enhance the connection between the courts between London and the regions. And they're particularly dealing with the international dispute resolution jurisdictions. And it's also going to act as a single umbrella for business specialist courts in England and Wales. It's going to encompass the specialty courts of the High Court, the Commercial Court, including the Admiralty Court, the Circuit Commercial Court, formerly the Mercantile Court, the Technology and Construction Court, and the Courts of the Chancery Division. So this is a pretty major reorganisation. Alex, I don't know if there's anything you want to comment on this, but it just smacks to me of increasing Europeanisation of the court system.
Yes, the area of the law of England and Wales which was Europeanised more than any other was family and property law, because of the mixed marriages and mixed partner businesses. So a partner in the business sense there, but also in the romantic sense, where, for example, one continental and one Brit started a family or a business together, and they had totally different expectations of judicature. So there were landmark rulings in the last 10 or 15 years where in each case a High Court judge or Crown Court judge seminally found that European Union law does apply, set aside common law in this case, for example, prenups, one example. And this is along that line, but there's another aspect to it, which is simple greed among the judiciary and a feeling that smaller common law jurisdictions like Singapore are eating our lunch by being the jurisdiction of preference for international blob-type companies to have disputes resolved in. Others are Ireland, for example, or the like. But Singapore in particular is running away with success because it's a predictable jurisdiction run on traditional British lines, thanks to Lee Kuan Yew. So in response, the Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales, John Thomas, Lord Thomas of Cwm Gwaith, has actually said at Legal Wales conferences, Cymru a'r Gyfraith conferences, that England and Wales needs to package its law, commercialise it, and make it a deal which is attractive to European and global companies. And I spotted this week that the Dutch Ministry of Security and Justice, yes, the two have one minister, which is very Orwellian, has invited Lord John Thomas, the presiding or the serving Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales, to address their invitation-only autumn conference over here in the Netherlands. And the conference is going to be on the future of the judge and the judge of the future. And Lord Thomas has been invited, because of his Brexit ruling, to speak on, quote, the independence of the judiciary. What do you think of that, Mike?
What is the future of the judge? Is the future of the judge AI, perhaps?
Well, coupled with what we were saying about intelligence, maybe things are going that way. A lot of companies don't, you know, they're not British, they don't have very good English speakers in them. They probably wouldn't notice the difference between an AI judgment and a traditional one handed down by an old-fashioned wig wearer. So I really don't know. But unfortunately, I'm not going to go get to ask Lord Thomas about his plans. By the way, Leveson's going to take over soon, the hot tip, as Lord Chief Justice, then we can really watch out. But I won't be able to ask him because it's an invitation-only conference for the Dutch legal great and good.
Yeah, okay.
I'll just say I was having trouble with independence and judges in the same sentence, but we'll leave it at that. I was fascinated by this article, Sputnik, reporting on the fact that the Iranians have produced a fifth-generation stealth fighter. It's called the F-313 Conqueror. This aircraft now flying. They're undertaking trials at the moment. So we have Iran that's moved into this level of of aviation, and we'll just remind people that we've now got Britain's aircraft carrier, Queen Elizabeth, which has no aircraft for it because, of course, the British government sold off all of our Harriers. The British government failed to support British industry to produce an upgraded supersonic and modern version of the Harrier. So there is our multi-billion pound carrier, Mike, with very clean flight deck. I think we should congratulate them on that clear flight deck. But of course, we've got the UK unable to build its own modern carrier-based fighter, but the Iranians could do it. And what I find so sad is that nobody in our media is actually asking the key question, how did this situation come to be? No politicians are being challenged over why they've utterly betrayed British industry and the skills base.
I think you're being very unfair because they did manage to land a helicopter on it a couple of days ago. So they have had some kind of aircraft on it, at least.
Well, that's true. But
it is. How many football fields? I mean, it'd be a hard job to miss, really, wouldn't it?
Probably three. Yeah.
Yeah. OK, let's move on to North Korea then. And China and Russia trying to encourage North Korea to stop playing games. The two sides propose that that North Korea, as a voluntary political decision, declares a moratorium on testing nuclear explosive devices and ballistic rocket launches, and the US and South Korea refrain from carrying out large-scale joint exercises. That's according to a joint statement from their ministries, foreign ministries. Parallel to this, the opposing side should start negotiations and affirm general principles of their relations, including the non-use of force, rejection of aggression, and peaceful coexistence. Alex, do you think what's going on with North Korea here is anything more than diversionary noise? What is North Korea up to?
It's always a very inscrutable regime, but I think what we have to bear in mind is that Kim, who is accused by Mr. Trump in all the tweets of being a nutter and a silly dictator, is actually being painted into a corner by his own military regime. That we've seen this happen in a lot of Asian ultra-left-wing regimes. And by the way, when you get to the ultra-left-wing, like the really hardcore Maoists and the Khmer Rouge, they actually flip round, and North Korea is a good example. They become ethno-based fascists, basically extreme right in their philosophy. And you need to read Meyer's book on North Korea to find out more about that. He's one of the few Western commentators who reads Korean. And so what's happened is that Kim, because he's third generation Kim now, he's basically not much more than a figurehead. This is simplifying a bit. And if he doesn't keep issuing the blood-curdling threats and allowing the nightly news to have footage of, you know, the Americans being threatened with a tapodong, then the military is going to chop him and find someone else, because they have a very good profitable thing going, forging $100 bills, selling slave labor timber to Japan. The Japanese know jolly well where it comes from. This is always what happens in the East Asian despotisms. The communist ideology is a front, and the big man blaring at the front is just a way of keeping the military machine sweet, which in the policy of North Korea, which is called Song-un, military first. That means the soldiers get to eat first. It's a lot less nice than it sounds. In the Song-un policy, the military runs the show, basically. If you're not in the military, you can't expect clothes or food. So that's the system. And I'm afraid they've got lots of dirty deals with lots of Western and general Asian countries and companies propping it up. So the military chest beating, I regard as just a front.
Well, perhaps this is where the EU is going, the direction at least. They expressed finally acknowledging something here. Britain to lead EU military mission, giving 1,500 soldiers to the cause even after Brexit. Well, I think we've been warning about this for quite some time. There's a very fetching of video of Ms. Mogherini there. I encourage people to go and look at that. And the Telegraph here reporting a German official saying that EU army is inevitable. And the mainstream media is still continuing to use this term EU army, implying that it's something which is separate from Britain. And of course, not using the word unification, because that might be nervous to certain people. Now, that German official was this gentleman, Dr. Hans-Peter Bartels. So what were your thoughts on this?
Well, as you see there on screen, he is talking about für eine europäische Armee. I am for a European army. So, and as you can also see there, he's with one of the parties. He's with the Socialist Party, the SPD. But Dr. Bartels, actually since late 2014, has been the Armed Forces Commissioner of the Bundestag. And the British press, with that Telegraph article you quoted, is pretending that this is all new stuff. But actually, as that website, which you just showed, explains, if you go onto it and read what he's been doing, before he was Armed Forces Commissioner, back 8 years at least before that, to 2006, he was calling for the proper term, European military integration, you see. So he himself is enjoying this limelight, because as long as people keep saying European army, which they do over here now, the Dutch are very worried about German takeover, as if they're just going to have their battalions surrendered, you know, that will keep the screen away, well, keep the screen in place and keep people's gaze averted from the real budgetary taxation and treasury integration at the heart of it. David Ellis at our Winchester conference of the British Constitution Group put this very well. He said the EU is a shield to protect the Bank for International Settlements, based, of course, just a few hundred yards over the border out of the EU in Basel in Switzerland with diplomatic immunity. That's where the policy comes together. And Bartels, because he's German and socialist, has been able to bang the drum openly in a way that the Brits would have been horrified to. But basically, he is on the same side as most of the Tory MPs in the end, including some of the ex-servicemen who pretend to be great service champions. They want to see, and so did Duncan Sands back in 1957 when he was junior minister for defence, they all want to see integration of European military industry. And that's the correct language to use on this.
And so is there an awareness within Netherlands society, or is it similar to the situation in the UK? Is there an awareness that there's already bilateral agreements, cooperation agreements between the Dutch and the German militaries, or is this something which has just had no coverage, as in the UK?
There hasn't been official coverage of it, but you can't miss it, because the flag officers, if you go out and watch a warship being launched in Flushing, as I've done once, or if you talk to servicemen who are, you know, armoured infantry, they will openly say, oh yes, we have German officers commanding us, or the Karel Dornmann is under joint German command, that's their big carrier, or such admissions. The only thing that doesn't seem to be done with the Germans jointly is air and air defence at the moment, but I expect that will come. But unfortunately, a lot of these countries, even the ones with the best equipment and best military traditions around Germany, so the Netherlands, the Czech Republic, Denmark, they were all, of course, they thought in 1939-40, it'll never happen to us. We've got the strength to resist, which they did. They had very good kit. And B, the Germans will never dare do such a thing. And of course, they were proven very sadly wrong. And they're still in this sense of denial, all these Germanics around Germany now. They're basically saying, well, we can't go it alone in this world of, you know, billion euro purchasing. We have to join forces with the Germans. I'm afraid that even some of the military officers I speak to have got this defeatist attitude. At least you don't have that in Britain yet. But on the continent, you do, this defeatist attitude of, well, the Germans are going to take it all over in the end anyway. The one thing the Germans don't have, of course, which you referred to with the Iranian case, is fifth generation fighter jets, because of the gentleman's agreement that's with their excellent engineering. And since the defeat in the Second World War, they would never build jets. But if they did, of course, they would be, I think, as good as Russian and outperform American ones. So then we will really be looking at a complete European army. But that doesn't need to happen. The Germans just need to appropriate British and French fissile material, nuclear submarines. They're talking openly about this in the Bundestag in several parties now. And then they've got the deal anyway. They will call it the Europäische Armee, but it will basically be commanding our assets.
Yeah. OK. Thanks for that, Alex. Now, just very briefly on this one then, of course, last week, we've mentioned this a couple of times, the OPCW so-called fact-finding mission confirms the use of chemical weapons in Syria on the 4th of April this year. You tweeted this out a day or two ago. Originally, this is basically asking Bellingcat how they got an advance sight of the full report. What is Elliot Higgins and what is Bellingcat, do you think?
Well, I mean, your guess is as good as mine, Mike. As soon as they got started, they call themselves a citizen journalists collective. And if I'm not wrong, they were started for MH17 investigation. So that was the Malaysian airliner, which was tragically downed as it took off from here in the Netherlands, and mostly holidaymakers and people going off to Kuala Lumpur, and was shot down, of course, over disputed territory in the eastern Ukraine. By the way, two Dutch citizen journalists have now come up with their conclusion that it probably was a Russian who hit the trigger, but the Ukrainians made so many mistakes that they and the international organizations covered up for them about the failure to seal the airspace. And they know a lot more about it than most other journalists do, so I'll believe them on that. But know that Bellingcat has for a year now, if not longer, it's been, well, 2 years now, hasn't it? It's been pretending to be the cutting edge of citizen journalism, but What they seem to be more involved in is astroturfing. You know, this astroturf as in fake grass, so fake grass roots. They, if you listen to Patrick Henningsen talking about that on our broadcast last week, he says the same thing. Journalists like to pick out a tweet here and, you know, an obscure story there and say, oh, look, there's grassroots interest in this, whereas, in fact, it's been actually engineered into position. So I don't know what your thoughts are on where Bellingcat is at, Mike. It doesn't look good.
No, I think I feel similarly to yourself. We'll discuss this more at some other time. Ryan.
Okay, well, let's just move on to the subject of Israel. This is a BBC report from a couple of weeks ago, but we thought it was important to have a look at it in the context of today, as it were. So we've got Avigdor Lieberman named as Israel's defence minister, and he's described as being a controversial right-wing Israeli politician. He's bringing his party in, which is going to shore up Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's one-seat majority. So there's a lot of politics going on in the background of it. Mr. Lieberman pledged to be responsible and reasonable in his policy. But the BBC did report that this had led to Moshe Yaalon, a member of Netanyahu's party, quitting as defence minister. And the reason he quit was he said that Israel was being taken over by dangerous and extreme elements, which is a very interesting statement. So if we come across to Sputnik here, we've got the same defence minister warning Syria and Lebanon, don't test us. This has come about as the result of a couple of mortar rounds landing close to Israeli territory. No injuries, no damage, but the response was a retaliatory raid targeting a Syrian military post as a result. So we have a couple of mortar rounds landing short, no damage, but that's instantly an Israeli raid. And here we now start to see the policy. So Lieberman has said this: we've no intention of entering any conflict, but I advise our neighbours not to test us. We will not tolerate any spillover into our territory. Keeping Assad in power is not in our security interests. So very clear here that Israel may claim to be sitting on the sidelines, but how it's actually influencing the fighting inside Syria, I think we can guess that there is support under the surface. And what is the Israeli objective is to actually get Assad out. I wanted to remind people, of course, of the power that Israel seems to have within British Parliament. Now, this is historic, but it certainly gives us an indication, because we had Malcolm Rifkin, former Security and Defence Committee, sorry, Intelligence and Security Committee, but also conservative friend of Israel. He's at the highest level of intelligence. All of the services there, GCHQ, MI5, MI6, William Hague himself, former Foreign Secretary, also conservative friend of Israel. And then, of course, we had David Cameron, who said that his belief in Israel is unshakable. So this situation hasn't changed just because David Cameron's gone. So we've got Israeli policy, which is clearly only going to be happy if Assad is removed. And we seem to have that same Israeli policy buried within UK's government. I find this very unnerving, Alex, that we should have another nation with such tremendous influence. I've said before, it doesn't matter particularly that it's Israel, because we could say if this was Germany or Italy boasting of the power it could wield over British politicians, I would have the same sense of unease. But there's something not right here, which is never discussed in the mainstream media.
Israel was conceived of as a sort of base of operations for a very secular, very anti-Christian and very anti-Jewish in the biblical sense enterprise. Lord Victor Rothschild really was summed it up best. He had Churchill's ear, of course, during the war, when he wrote, I think it was, to a friend, "One thing is sure, when the land," meaning Israel, "is set up after the war, there will be no room in it for poor schnorrers," meaning mustachio-wearing religious Jews. So there is this absolute disdain, which Gilad Atzmon writes about in his books, by the Western European secular Ashkenazim for religious and observant Jews, and particularly the Eastern European ones. Now, when Israel was set up, it was the Eastern European socialistic ones that were in the lead for a generation. So you had labor, you had the kibbutzim, basically collectivism and Marxism taking over. From the 70s onwards, the Likudnikim, so the Likud party heavies, moved in. You know, so Ben Gurion's lot went, and the new philosophy that that came in was in the time of let me think, Menachem Begin. Yes, was very much more, we're going to expand. So there was a kind of, it was still secularist, but there was a belief that, okay, we'll use the religious Judaism side of it to persuade the world and persuade our own people that we have a right to push out to the Sinai and up to Damascus. Just as a sideline, a lot of people think that Zionism wants to occupy all the territory between the Nile and Euphrates. That's a misreading of the Old Testament. That's not even been the Zionist claim. It's actually what they want is from the River of Egypt, which is in Sinai, to Damascus. That's the headwaters of the Euphrates. So there's a particular, shall we say, explaining away in all strands of Israeli ideology that, okay, Damascus, we have an entitlement to. That's one of the reasons why Assad has been hammered so hard. I've got into this a bit in a follow-up interview with Peter Ford for Insight Vox, which we have in the can. And he says, yes, we can't discount that the Israelis will push beyond the Golan Heights into further into Syria proper, shall we say. So the thing to watch out, particularly if you're of a Christian or Jewish mindset and think stop bashing Israel, is there's been several changes of the guard before and during the creation of the State of Israel. And we have seen a huge shift from basically Israel being any other nation based on welfare and social progress to it being a beachhead for some other project. And that's why Israel is so dangerous. And if you're involved in a church which likes to support Israel, I think you need to inform yourself about these things.
Thank you.
Okay, Alex, we'll move back to the European Union. Now, I saw this little video clip. I'm sorry, Alex, I wasn't able to produce include the video for today, but EU Observer here headline saying Juncker lashes out at ridiculous EU Parliament. And Juncker and the, who of course heads up as President of the European Commission, and the Chair of the European Parliament, the Speaker, President, whoever it was, really having a running spat on the floor. It was quite incredible.
We've not seen much like this, Mike, and it reminds me of Acts chapter 2 when the Apostle Peter is accused of being drunk because he's rambling and he says, well, we can't be drunk, it's only 9 o'clock in the morning. Well, this was 9:15 yesterday morning, and I challenge anyone to watch that video and come away with the conclusion that Herr Juncker was stone-cold sober while he was giving that speech. I mean, he's flailing around. He's doing what we interpreters always train even basic speakers never to do, which is bang the microphone with his sleeve, which causes a huge shock in your head if you're listening through sensitive earphones. But there he is saying only 30 of you have turned up to hear the Maltese Prime Minister give an account of his six-month presidency of the Council of Europe. And you're ridiculous. I will never come to such a meeting again. He gets red in the face, tears well up. Typical blotto, really. And in fact, in that little vignette, if you watch it, people must go to that page, EU Observer, and watch the embedded clip. There are three of the four presidents of the European Union involved in that vignette. There is President of the European Parliament, Antonio Tajani, saying, Juncker, sort yourself out, stop calling us ridiculous. You've got the one that everyone thinks is the president, which is Juncker, President of the European Commission. And you've got the Maltese Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat, who's just stopped being President of the Council of the European Union. But that's not all the presidents the European Union has to offer, because absent from the scene is the Pole, Donald Tusk, who is President of the European Council. Is it clear yet?
Well, it is very clear, because clearly the European Union thinks so highly of itself that it needs multiple presidents. But what was really fascinating in the argument was the whole balance of power thing between who is in charge. Is the European Parliament telling the European Council what to do, or is European Council telling the European, or sorry, the European Commission telling the European Parliament what to do? And I wasn't certain that Junckers was actually prepared to accept that the Parliament was supposed to be in charge.
No, he wouldn't, because he wouldn't even in a constitutional argument admit that, because his body, the European Commission, is anterior and superior. It was never set up to have a parliamentary check and balance, or indeed the European Council, which is the heads of government controlling it. Both of those institutions, the Council and the Parliament, were set up decades after the Commission, because governments and people started saying, hang on, do we get a say here? And they still don't have a right of initiation of legislation. That has to come from the Commission. Those MEPs don't actually draft bills. You know, so it was a bit of a progress that Juncker this time, okay, it's bad English. They're both, Trajani is using Italian and Juncker switches from French to bad English halfway through that clip. But he says, okay, I accept the Parliament controls the Commission. But he's using that in the French-Italian sense, contrôler, which is to verify the work of, to scrutinise. You know, it doesn't go further than that. The Commission runs the shop. And he has grudgingly had to accept in his term and his predecessor term that the MEPs actually have some right of oversight of what the Commission is doing. But he's basically in saying in this clip, effectively, OK, I've deigned to be scrutinised by you lot, but, you know, you're such a populist rabble. I'm never going to do this again. I don't like having to appear here. You know, I think he had some Dutch comfort courage before he went on. So, yes, there is a huge power struggle there. But even if the Commission has got the whip hand in law, the optics of it are coming out very strongly for Trajani, the Speaker of Parliament there. And people could yet see that MEPs, are regarded as the acceptable face of the EU, the way that things are going with the kind of MEPs that are being returned to office now. And we could actually see the Commission seriously having to batten down the hatches against this opposition within Brussels.
OK, well, look, we're absolutely out of time, so let's just end on this one. Alex, am I right in saying that Helmut Kohl in the lying in state?
Yes, this is me being cheeky, suggesting it's First Secretary Chernenko lying in state. I mean, Brian will remember watching, Kremlinology, as it was called in those days. And I cannot see any difference apart from the red being blue. I mean, the stars are there, the flags are there, the sober band, the lugubrious wreaths. The odd salutes by men in mismatched uniforms, the oversized portrait, it's a wooden, almost waxwork scene, isn't it? And I can't believe that the flags of nations like Lithuania, Poland and Hungary are in there after they went through it all a generation ago.
Well, look, Alex, I have to say, I was in Warsaw, I think, when they were holding the referendum about whether they were going to join the European Union. There weren't terribly many people protesting against it, but the point they were making was, first of all, it was the Nazis, then it was the Russians, and now you want to be controlled by the European Union. Yeah. And so your point is well made. I don't understand, but although we have to say, don't we, that the current regime in Poland is pretty anti-European Union.
Oh, yes. If viewers want to look up more, I think this is the year when this is becoming mainstream awareness in Western Europe. Visegrad, V-I-S-E-G-R-A-D, Visegrad Group or Visegrad Alliance, Visegrad 4, any of those terms on YouTube will get you into subtitled speeches, particularly by the Polish and Hungarian politicians, but also some by the Czechs now, like we covered last week. And there is a huge amount of resistance now against those projects. And it is articulate resistance based on historical arguments. And crucially, it has the bulk of the population behind it, from the mildly conservative or centre-left right through to anyone who's not a raving nationalist fascist. So there's something like 70% support in Poland and Hungary for the anti-EU or anti-migrant quota, at least policies of the ruling parties, the governing parties. So that there is a serious thorn here in the side of the EU.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we will finish there today. And we're going to say that tomorrow we have some updates for the UK column to make. So there will be no UK column news tomorrow. We will be back. I'm losing track of my days now, Mike.
Well, I'll be back with David on Friday.
Friday.
Yeah,
indeed. So Mike will be back with you on Friday. Thank you very much for joining us. And if you're wondering what to do in these deeply troubled times, we say start off with pushing out the truth about what is going on. Britain is being attacked by its own government. We need to expose what's happening. People need to understand it. Once they understand what's happening, then, of course, we can start to do something to stop it. So this is deeply troubled times, but we don't look at it that what's happening is unstoppable. It's simply enough people to understand what's happening on a daily basis. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.